was like, oh no, if they don't know, I have no chance of figuring this out. And then I just realized how big and how nascent this whole space is. Because the reality is, when you get deep enough into the work that actually needs to be done, you realize that it's the creative, the strategic human elements that result in good sales. When you're just focused on the feature that AI enables, that could be wiped out very quickly. The thing that isn't going to get wiped out is the merchandiser, the writer, the lawyer, that specialized skill set. What is their actual day-to-day?
Welcome to Artificial Insights, the podcast where we interview innovators and leaders in AI to learn how AI is changing the future of work and business. Today, we're joined by Bijan Vaez, and I've been looking forward to interviewing him before I even had a podcast. He's the current CEO of MerchKit, 3 times founder, investor, and the former co-founder of EventMobi, where he scaled event technology to millions of users. He's been a part of the mobile, SaaS, and now AI revolutions. I met him through a venture program I went through run by Antler, where he was an advisor here in Toronto. Bijan, could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a third-time founder now. I've been building SaaS products since 2008, first with the mobile revolution, and then through the SaaS playbook, and now in AI. I had the pleasure of also getting involved with Antler Canada and supporting their portfolio companies as a VC firm. So I've had my hands in the startup ecosystem for pretty much my whole career, which has been really fun. And predominantly as a technical leader, as a CTO, this will be my first stint as a CEO leading this new startup that I'm working on, MerchKit. And we are definitely at the forefront of, I would say, applied AI, and we can dig into that as well.
Thank you. And I think a question that's on everybody's mind for a podcast like this is, Bijan, are you an AI?
I am not an AI. I am actually human. And I think there's a very interesting discussion to be had of where that intersection really comes through, and where I think as engineers who are building with AI, where we should be focusing our time, I think is really important.
I do like that discussion, because it seems like every week there's a new release of something that can do coding and build bigger projects. So I'll ask you that question a bit later. But I like what you said about what you're working on now is at the forefront of applied AI. What does that mean?
Yeah, so maybe I'll step back into how I even got into this journey. But I was first exposed to GPT-3. Actually through one of the Antler founders, and they had talked about using it or playing around with it for a use case. And I had no idea what it was. I dug into it, was totally dumbfounded. And very shortly after, as I was kind of exploring it, I think the first open source version of Stable Diffusion was released. And I was like, oh, okay, this is happening. I have to figure out something here. And I think I'm very early, not knowing how the space was going to play out very shortly. And so I thought I had an opportunity to rebuild my knowledge and go through and figure out an opportunity to kind of play into that space. So I went into learning how to build transformers and all sorts of stuff, and kind of just the algorithms, and really digging deep into the math behind it and how it works, thinking that I could really step into that field. And I remember I went to CVPR a couple of years ago and started just like, I had so many questions. I was like, oh, I'm going to go straight to the researchers and ask them all this stuff, and I'm going to figure it out, and then I can build a product with it. And pretty much every single researcher that I asked all my hard questions to were like, I don't know how it works. Like, we're all learning yet. Here we go. And I was like, oh no, if they don't know, I have no chance of figuring this out. And then I just realized how big and how nascent this whole space is. And I had to really step back and realize that I am not a researcher. I don't have the funds to power the type of research that's needed to move the frontier forward at that scale. And so I stepped back and said, okay, if I can't push the models forward, but I can leverage the models to connect it to business problems, and that's where I can step into, where are the opportunities there? And after about 6 months of trying to figure something out, I had to step back, reset my expectations, and start to attack it from what I call applied AI, which is really around whatever is being put out there in the open source world or even closed source world, how can I leverage every single release, every single update, every single model improvement, and apply that to a business context that I know deeply to actually create value for end users? And I think that's what I would call applied AI.
I like that. And I get asked frequently by people who want to get involved with AI, do I need a PhD to get involved with AI? How do I do this? I like what you said about even trying to do that and going to a conference, the computer vision conference. But what would you say to someone who asks a question like that? Do I need a PhD to get involved?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you realize how big and large and impactful this field is, you can look at it historically in, let's say, large scale web applications or mobile kind of world and all the different areas and niches that people were able to build a skill set or build a career in. Now you're looking at AI, which is so proliferated across so many different areas. Absolutely not. There's so many different areas that you can find your specialty into. And even early on, like the whole notion of even people being hired as prompt engineers is like a really interesting notion, right? But it just exposes that, yes, there's all these researchers who are building the models, but making them effective is not a super technical problem. It's actually a much broader problem set to tackle. And you absolutely don't need a PhD to do that work.
What you said you did was took your expertise in business and then started using AI in that. So what would you say is a good step to do that, your expertise with AI?
Yeah, the main thing I always, every single time I embark on a new project, it's always have a goalpost of something that you want to build. So whatever wheelhouse that you love playing in, your hobby, the communities that you're a part of, find a problem there and just say, you know what, I'm going to use this technology to make this thing that I already know a little bit better. And now that might not be the thing that you end up working on, but I think that kind of works your curiosity in a way where it's self-sustaining, where you're kind of self-motivated to figure it out because you care about that hobby or you care about that community that you want to serve. And so it gives you a little bit of an incentive to just keep playing and keep tinkering and keep just taking that one step further than you normally would. And so when I see a lot of folks trying to build the generic apps, or let's say even like a to-do list app, right? It's like, yeah, okay, you can look at a course and it'll give you the instructions to the to-do list. You'll get halfway through, you get really bored and you drop it and you say, okay, I get the idea. I'm not really going to finish it. But if it's something that's a little bit more intrinsically motivating you, I think that's really the key. And that was for me, like what we're building now is not what I started with, but it got me exposed into the world. It got me into the right communities where I learned a lot. It got me into talking to folks that gave me exposure into other areas. And if I was just doing this for the sake of doing a course, yeah, it wouldn't really have gone that far. I probably would have put it aside at some point and kind of moved on and gone back to what I was doing before, right?
And with what you're doing now, how did that journey happen? And you mentioned pivoting, I think, more than once as like when you start your own ideas, you probably won't finish with that idea.
Yeah.
But also you mentioned that you've pivoted a few times. So could you tell us that journey?
Yeah. I mean, my sense was when there's transformational change happening at a time like this, it's almost hard to pick what you want to work on because there's so many opportunities out there. And so my general approach to this is, okay, then if that's the scenario, go to areas where there's just biggest mass market available. So like your biggest, you know, total addressable market out there and just start there and find something in a really big market. It doesn't matter what it is specifically that you're working on, just that it has a large market because your first couple iterations are probably not going to be the thing. But if there's a big enough market, you can keep tinkering and there's enough customers to like throw a new idea at, right? And you're kind of at least constrained to a similar customer base. You're just tossing different ideas around to those customers to see what hits. Then there's always growth beyond that. If you're going to something really small where there's only 10 customers and you miss the first few times, you can't go back to the same customer. They're like, no, wait, I got something new for you, right? You kind of burn your bridges at some point of them giving you the attention that you need to validate. So I kind of went out to a really big market, which was, hey, commerce is going to be upended in many different ways. Let me go after biggest cost centers in commerce, which, you know, is content creation and photography. And I personally love photography. I'm a very visual person. And so I was like, you know, this actually marries a lot of things that I like. Like, I'm very motivated by solving this problem, and I love tinkering with Stable Diffusion. And so started out with trying to build a product photography tool that would offload a lot of work that retailers needed to do. Actually, it was mainly for D2C brands. It was much smaller. And built a product. I missed the AI wave, like the hype wave that came through. And tons of early kind of competitors were out there, everyone trying to get attention. And realized very quickly that the type of customers and the expectations that they had of what AI should or could be doing was very mismatched with where the research was at the time. And which was fine. But I think as I used that to then dig deeper into their business problems, I was like, oh man, none of these customers have a lot of money. They're all looking for something super cheap and free, and doing image generation inference is not cheap. And I was trying to run my own infra on AWS. And I was like, oh man, I need to get to a certain level of scale until this thing even makes sense. And that itself is a whole ballgame to deal with. And very quickly, I was like, okay, this is not the market. And so I have to figure out either a different product, or I have to figure out how to go up market into the type of customers who have a lot more money to spend. If I'm having a hard time convincing people to sign up for a $20 a month subscription, like, that's going to be tough to build a business around, especially with the cost of inference. And this was 2 years ago, right? It was much, much more expensive than it is now. And I kind of leveraged that first prototype to go out and just talk to people, because it was a hot topic and it's very, again, easy to explain the value of it. But as soon as I would get them on the call, I'd swap the conversation to be like, let's forget about photography. What other problems are you dealing with today? And explored a lot of those different areas. And obviously, a lot of them were talking to me because I was at the frontier of AI and they were trying to figure out AI in their own business. And it led into a lot of interesting, I would say, it was a good culmination of, we had a couple dozen different calls with customers that all ended in, you know, I really want to use this AI thing, but every time I've put what we need to do in ChatGPT, it's just like, it's garbage and I have to do more work cleaning it up and it doesn't actually save me any time. And I think I was able to bridge that gap by understanding what really AI could do and where, you know, the boundaries of OpenAI and ChatGPT are, and saying, okay, this is interesting. So like, why didn't it work for you? Digging into the whys. Where that ended up was essentially realizing that, hey, they're working at a much larger data scale, which is they're not feeding in one piece of data at a time and trying to analyze and optimize that for the prompt that they're giving ChatGPT. They're dumping in, here's 150 products and go and run this analysis for me. And then it's garbage in, garbage out, because they don't have actually enriched data that they're feeding ChatGPT with. And they're expecting it to do magic for them. And again, those mismatched expectations. And what we focused on was saying, okay, the reason why it's not working for them is actually that they're feeding it really bad data. So can we actually go and clean up data for them? And then we realized, okay, we don't really have context around the data, and trying to do that is like a massive data science problem that I'm not, again, qualified to really jump into. But if you step even further back, where is the source of data coming from? Because if we can attack at the source of ingestion, we have the context of like, where did the data come from? Is there any supplementary data that maybe wasn't ingested that's causing this, or whatever other reasons? And if we can then enrich the data, then the downstream workflows become very simple to do, because the models are getting better, reasoning capabilities are getting better, it's getting cheaper to do inference, all that sort of stuff. Everything becomes easy, but we need to help them actually get clean and rich data into their systems. And so that is essentially what ended up being the genesis of what MerchKit is now.
Okay. And before I ask you more specifically what MerchKit is doing now, I think what you just outlined there is fascinating, because I get asked a lot about the limits of AI. How does that impact what we can do? And it sounds like that drove you towards solving a problem that's closer to data entry than it is AI. Like, how did you discover that, and how did the limitations of AI play into that?
Yeah, I mean, it is, but I think to solve those problems, and why those problems haven't been solved yet with previous sets of technology, or when you look at the history of retail technology, a lot of it was really complex, you know, data science teams, machine learning algorithms that were customized and built for the for individual retailers to do this work. And it was just really expensive. And that's why it never really took off. And so there were a lot of great researchers that built amazing products, but I think, again, a little too ahead of their time in what really the technology could enable. And what we realized was, hey, we can attack these relatively old school non-AI problems with this newfound capabilities that we have, because we don't need to train custom ML models to accomplish this. The LLMs actually have enough source data in them, plus a little bit of fine-tuning. You can actually get an equivalent output that's actually more generalized than those like custom ML models that were being built previously. And so we're like, okay, this is a new way to attack this age-old problem that is actually very important. And so now we can start to stitch and bring together the non-AI to this AI flow of what we're seeing.
Very cool. And what about your understanding of AI and what it could or couldn't do? Did you bring to that problem, or did you discover during that problem? What was that balance?
Yeah, I would say there's a mix of that. There was some of, okay, I think we can do this. And then having really great early customers that allowed us time and gave us patience to go and experiment to figure it out. And then I think I was very lucky that I brought on Rob Hayes, my co-founder, because he was leading product of Voiceflow, where they had machine learning teams pre-LLM, and then at the cusp of LLMs coming on board, where they'd done a lot of this experimentation as well. So I think he had it ingrained in him of how to experiment in this space. And so we start to uncover a lot of this stuff as the capabilities were being built out. You know, when folks started leveraging LLMs for structured output, we were pretty much like right there. When we started to do data extraction from various sources, we were just right there. It just lined up really nicely with, as the community was uncovering these capabilities, what LLMs could actually do, we ended up being like, oh yeah, our customer actually wants this, and maybe we could do this, and let's figure out how to leverage it. And then what are the tools and how do we open that up? But I would say, again, I'm not a researcher, so it's not like I had prior knowledge. It was literally all just tinkering as fast as we could and seeing what the capabilities could open up for us.
And it sounds like some aspect of that is keeping up with the community that's talking about how they're using it.
Yes.
Is there a community or two that you would say has been the most helpful?
I would say almost 100% dominantly is on X right now. So
very cool.
I'm part of a bunch of Discords and different research communities as well. And you get some good information, but generally not as applicable from the applied AI sense. I find the discussions, or like there's, I would say, maybe half a dozen folks, especially on X, that are putting out amazing content that it's not even engagement bait or like to try to build an audience. They're just talking about how they're using and building, and it's just for their own curiosity and just a way to talk about it. And that has been like fantastic. That's been the most impactful, I would say.
I'll ask you for those people afterwards and maybe link to them, because knowing how people are using it and getting involved is something that I think everybody's curious about.
For sure.
Going back to what MerchKit does now, what is the problem that you're solving now, and how does the data science versus AI fit into it?
Yeah. So if you're a part of a retail or marketplace or large enterprise brand, and you're trying to launch new products, you're trying to sell your products in different channels. So let's say you want to list up your product on Amazon and on Walmart and on your own Shopify store, and maybe put it on eBay, et cetera, et cetera. All of this work requires a really hefty amount of data entry work on your team. So, oh, okay, we want to list this on Amazon. Oh no, they've asked us for 20 more questions for 20 more fields for every single product. And especially if you are a retailer and you're stocking 10,000 products, we have customers that have 140,000 products. We're doing a POC with a customer that has 7 million products. Like, this is an impossible task for you to do. And so if you want to grow your business, you're pretty much stuck in like, how do we actually manage this operationally? And previously that was this, they'd hire data science folks to come in and build machine learning models to figure out, okay, how do we find the best match of data given our existing data set against what the requirements are and can we fill those out? I think what we realized was, okay, if we can offload all of this operational overhead from them, so all the data entry work, the review work, just the grunt work that's required to take any action for merchandising these products, they can actually start to move significantly faster. And these companies become more strategic in the work that they're doing. They're not bogged down in just data work and cleanup work and all that stuff, right? And so that's really what we've opened up with our customers. And so what that looks like in the product is we're able to automatically ingest data into your catalog from whatever data sources that exist. So let's say you are stocking Samsung electronic products, we will go to the source of where Samsung publishes their product specs and everything that surrounds the Samsung catalog of products. We'll ingest it, we'll contextualize it in a vector database, and then we will actually go to our customer's catalog and say, okay, what is the structured output that you need that fits into your database fields? And we will actually infer what the right values should be, because a lot of times it's not a one-to-one match, right? We're not finding the thing. We actually need to run some rationale on why we're generating this value for you. And what that looks like is, for the most simplest case, is Samsung might provide their some volume or size metrics in imperial units, or say in metric units, and like the customers in the US and they wanted an imperial. And so literally it would have been someone's job to be like, okay, let me take these centimeters and convert it to inches and then copy paste the values. And you're doing this across thousands of products. And now we can actually, instead of writing all this custom code as well, or building machine learning models that would do this sort of stuff, it's actually cheap enough now with inference to just say, hey, like, let the LLM just do this work and do the calculations, wow, figure out what the calculations should be, and give it a suite of tools for it to work with. And that's part one, is getting the data in automatically with no work involved. Then it becomes enriching the existing data to say, hey, we now hold all these data points for every single product on your shelf. Now, let's say the discussion of tariffs is really important, and a lot of retailers want to identify which one of their products are made in Canada, what's made in the US, what's made in Australia. How do you determine that? Okay, there's an instruction set. You have to go look at the product, see where, you know, the product is manufactured, or the majority of the parts that make up the product, where they were manufactured. It requires a lot of digging, not just an understanding, but we have the context, the data. We can actually go and infer those values and enrich their data for them. And then downstream effects, they want to now leverage all this really enriched, complete data to create personalized campaigns, marketing content, new product descriptions, emails for a specific customer base, et cetera. That becomes really easy for generative AI to actually do now at a high quality bar, because we actually are feeding it good data to come through.
Wow. That sounds like a lot of work just to manage a product catalog. And where you started out from, I don't know that I would have imagined getting into that problem.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, how do you trust the LLM to do the reasoning? Because you mentioned it does do some reasoning in there, some calculations and things like that. How do you trust it?
Yeah, so we have a lot of guardrails, and especially the way that we build our product, it kind of forces a lot of structure on the LLM. And then the way that we visualize this to our end customers is actually giving it a confidence and a rationale of why it's actually producing this output. So if the confidence score is generally less than 80%, 70%, we'll highlight it in red to say, hey, as the merchandiser who has product knowledge, you should review this thing because we're not really sure if we got it right. So it's good for a human to actually tell us if it's right or wrong. And also they can come in and flag that. The interesting part though is when we reviewed the existing workflows as like what they would normally do pre-AI, a lot of times these retailers would give this data over to an offshore data entry team and allow them to go through and open up PDFs and copy paste values and that sort of thing. They still had 60, 70% completion rate. Like they had quite a bit of a big error rate for some of the work, especially if it was really technical. And so they still had to do a lot of review work. You know, they'd send it off on Monday, get it back on Friday. They'd spend the next 3 days reviewing the work that the offshore team did to make sure it was good or not. And I'm like, hey, well, at least now that whole week that you're waiting for this work to come back, it's done in like an hour. And then you can now just do your review work as you need it to. The whole process just moves a lot faster. I think that also speaks to, we're not trying to replace anyone with AI. It really is augmenting their existing workflows and just making it more efficient and faster.
Yeah, because I think that's a really key topic in this area, is how is that impacting the work that humans have to do? And it sounds like you might not have to work with an offshore data team, but is there more to it than that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think their reliance on those offshore teams drops. I don't think it necessarily goes away. I think similarly for those offshore teams, if they leverage these tools, they can just service more customers and they do it at a cheaper rate, do more work. And so I think, as you've probably seen it in coding as well, you can't replace the engineer, but the engineer can get a 10 to 100x output in the work that they're doing. And I think that's the reality of what AI is doing. I can't say merchandising work is going to get completely automated. All you have to do is hit a button. It's a wrong message to send out. And I think it's conflating and causing issues in the market of what is actually possible with AI. Because the reality is, when you get deep enough into the work that actually needs to be done, you realize that it's the creative, the strategic human elements that result in good sales, a good product, a good piece of writing. That is still very human. And the things that we relate to and that we will respond to in the market is to a human output that is relevant of what's happening in society and relevant of what's happening in culture at any given time. And so you can't rely on AI to do that for you, but all the legwork leading up to it, yeah, that can be automated. Let's get the 90% of the grunt work done, and let's allow the human to do the 10% that, you know, is the reason why they're doing the work that they're doing.
What have you heard from the people doing that 10% that now use your product? Do they love it?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because in the beginning, it was certainly those conversations of a little bit of angst of, is this what's going to happen if I use this tool? Am I going to lose my job? And we got into general availability last week, actually, with our product. So we did a full set of new demos again now, and we're handing the product actually over to those customers. And that same individuals were like, bright smiles. Oh my God, I don't have to do this anymore. This is amazing. Now I can actually do the work that I want to do. And I think that was a really cool reaction to see once we actually gave the product to them, to say, hey, like, your job is actually more important than ever because you have a specialty, you have a skill set, and now you get to practice your skill set. You don't have to do grunt work anymore. It just really, it's all creative output now.
I love that AI allowing people to practice their skill set, do what they're good at.
Totally. Yeah.
Actually, in this space, is there anything you've seen that you did not expect at all when you started?
Yeah. I mean, I think fairly generic, but I think we're all still in awe of this, is how fast it's moving and I thought it would take quite a few years until, you know, there was education and people leaned into it. And the rapid nature of also how non-technical folks are leaning into this has been really surprising. The crazier part is how fast the capabilities are opening up as well to match those expectations. And so for us who are building in the space, it's an insane time period where you're just constantly trying to drink from the fire hose, but also turn around and try to explain it and then go back and be like, oh, it's changed again. Okay, wait, hold on. Let's find something else. And so that, I think, is something totally new that I don't think anybody's really experienced yet. You know, when I was at the forefront of mobile, I had a year to tinker around with how to optimize something or some performance or offline mobile or whatever that looked like, until I could go and explain it. And then I had another year to sell that product. It was, you know, it was a natural, maintainable set of progress, but now it's just mayhem, which is really exciting, but also exhausting at the same time.
True. Everything seems to change every week.
Yeah.
That reminds me of another question. So many businesses feel like they build around a limitation of the AI underneath it, like couldn't upload PDFs to ChatGPT at first, and now you can, so there's no business there to be had around it. How do you build a business that isn't just fitting into that niche that they currently can't do, but might do later.
Yeah. I think this kind of goes both ways. It'll speak to the technology companies and the builders, but also the non-technical businesses and how they should evaluate who they pick and work with. For the builders, I think for me anyways, it's really important to find that customer base and go super, super deep into what the customer actually needs to get done. And so whenever I see AI tools get released where they promise things again with mismatched expectation, what that tells me is like they haven't gone deep enough to what the customer actually needs. They're just building on what they think is the next cool AI capability to get buzz and noise out there. But that's actually, again, when you're just focused on the feature that AI enables, that could be wiped out very quickly. The thing that isn't going to get wiped out is, again, the merchandiser, the writer, the lawyer, whatever that skill set, that specialized skill set, what is their actual day-to-day? Because some of it's AI, some of it's not AI, some of it is a multitude of different multimodal AI pieces that are needed. And that nuanced workflow is the stuff that ChatGPT is never really going to step into, right? Because that's not their game. Their game is to be a generalized provider. I think the opportunities are to connect those capabilities really deeply into the day-to-day of a human's work. And I think that's where people should focus their time. Now, on the other hand of how businesses should choose, a lot of these AI products are forcing annual contracts. And you're like, I don't know what's going to happen in a month from now, let alone be locked in for a year. How do I make this decision? I think the reality is you have to build trust with any of the vendors that you're working with. And you have to feel comfortable that the folks that you're working with are actually at the forefront of AI and are thinking about it properly, that as the underlying models change, as the capability changes, features become available, then, you know, your vendor is going to respond accordingly. They're not just slapping something on top. And then a month later, they realize their business is done. And then they're not really focused on you as a customer anymore. And they're trying to pivot into another business. It's like, no, find somebody who understands your business. Is really more concerned about helping you grow. And then also is very smart in their understanding of AI. And then I think that is generally a good business partnership.
Sounds like buying an AI product becomes more of a relationship because of the speed of change.
Yeah, which is really funny in that way. It's actually a more human connection relationship than it is just trusting AI again to do all this stuff, right?
Yeah, no, that's a great side effect. What do you see as, and since we just talked about speed, maybe this is an impossible question, but what do you see as the future of AI?
Yeah, I mean, there's a really interesting point because as we are, you know, and I think features are commoditized, so there's nothing really that I think will be too surprising there. We'll just get faster and faster at building stuff. The interesting parts that do open up is, I don't know, maybe it's the wrong analogy, but in my mind, this is for folks that are in the finance world. I remember when high frequency trading was becoming a thing and I didn't understand the stock market. And I, you know, and at first as a student, you're like, okay, well, kind of understand how stocks work. You make these picks and then there's call options. And then you talk to folks in New York who are doing high frequency trading and how they're using like FPGAs to be able to actually get 10 millisecond faster trades than the next hedge fund. And it's just a complete algorithm that's actually making trades. It's not a human making trade because you're moving so much faster. You know, like, wait, humans just got removed completely from the loop of how the stock market works. Like it's just computers doing the talking to each other. And so that analogy, I think, to me anyways, makes sense in how it translates to AI, which is we started out slow. Humans are navigating, talking to this, opening up the capabilities. We're building the things that become useful. And then it's going to come to a point where that, let's say AI interoperability or like the agentic interoperability, I think is going to be, to me, the next frontier. And that could be, I mean, the next 6 months, like who knows how fast it's going to move in that space. But how do you build your AI system to manage someone's world and then open that world up to another system's AI world? The great part is to me where this was traditionally just all GraphQL, REST implementations, like integrations of data that spent so much time trying to connect systems up. Like, well, actually that you don't need that anymore because we can transform data on the fly. We can actually generate it for data on the fly. And so it's really just about what is the protocol that someone's AI system can talk to another AI system and move data back and forth to it. I think that's a really interesting kind of next frontier of all of this that I'm really excited to see the projects that people start putting out here.
Yeah, I actually just saw one this week where it's over a voice call, which I thought was hilarious because we make AI systems work on phones because we want them to talk to humans, but it's specifically for an AI agent calling an AI agent. And when they confirm that they're both AI, they switch to this, it sounds like a modem, like sending data through screeches instead of through text because it's faster. It's just this weird adaptation to a human system.
Totally. But,
yeah, I'm excited to see all of that.
Yeah.
I have a question that's interesting to me personally, which is you mentioned that you've been a CCO many times and you're now stepping into this company as CEO. What difference does that make? And does that change how you think about AI?
Yeah, I mean, I would say generally as CTO, you're more focused on staying at the forefront of what technical capabilities are there. And are we making the right choices that will serve the company's best interests over the long term, right? So your architectural decisions and all that sort of stuff. And so you have to be tinkering, you have to be building to go through that. I think as CEO, and especially in a technical field, you really have to be more focused on anticipating your customers' needs given what's happening in the market. It's like a slight nuanced change, which is you're still connecting the technology, but it's not just what is the best technology out there. It's mainly around like, where's the technology moving now? And like, where should we be positioning ourselves in that movement with our customers? And so once that gets defined, I think that's where the CTO really comes in and hardens to say, okay, if that's actually where we want to play, then this is the best set of technology for us to leverage to accomplish that. But I think it's a much more nebulous task for a CEO to figure out, especially in an AI world, of where do we want to position ourselves in this breadth of how we could be serving your customers? And what do we not want to be doing? Because I think that also then helps the CTO determine, you know, their limitations and their requirements, kind of what they actually should build. So I think that nuance is definitely being played out right now.
That sounds like a difficult task with things changing so fast.
Yeah, exactly. But again, like you double down on just saying, okay, forget the future. I mean, not literally, but like you can't dwell on the future too much. And so you can only do what your customers need at any given point. And you just have to build agility into your team and into your business. And so all you can do is just stay more and more connected to what people need right now. Having the vision and talking about what the future could hold, that's fine. But I don't need to bring that into the company at the moment. At the moment, I need to solve my customer problems. And then if we need to dump this whole thing and move over to something else in 6 months because the world has changed, then that's what we got to do. But I can't go and predict what 6 months down the road is going to be and try to build for that. I think that's going to be... That's a good way to spend a lot of VC money and not build anything useful.
Yeah. And is there anything that you'd like to share about what you're working on now and how we can connect with you?
Yeah, I mean, I think we went through a wide range of kind of the stuff that we're working on, from data ingestion and inference and even from the media side. Like, we're working on quite a wide range of modalities in AI and trying to be at the frontier. And now that we've actually raised our pre-seed round, we're starting to grow the team. If folks are interested in the space, just share notes, or if they want to work with us, definitely would love to stay in touch and learn from each other, share what we've been working on in a lot more detail.
Awesome. And is LinkedIn a good place to connect with you?
LinkedIn, for me, now that I'm CEO, is unfortunately the best place.
I started this podcast because I wanted to stand at the gate of businesses using AI and see what separated hype from lasting impact. Back when cities had walls, you had to go into the city to do business at the market. So, if you wanted to talk to someone, you waited by the gate until they came in or came out. Do that enough times and you could talk to everyone. That's what I want to do, stand at the gate of people doing business with AI and talk to them, see what they do and why they do it. If you know someone that's making an impact in the world of AI, would you connect them with me? You can find me on LinkedIn or shoot me an email at daniel@maneri.house. That's daniel@manary.house. Thanks for listening.